now to begin the program, please welcome David Gregory and Reverend Alan Jones. Happy holidays, everyone. Thank you.
Good evening and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org, on Facebook and Twitter, and on your YouTube channel. I'm Alan Jones, Dean Emeritus of Grace Cathedral here in San Francisco, and your moderator for today's program. Our guest tonight is veteran journalist David Gregory. David served as chief White House correspondent for NBC News during George W. Bush's presidency and contributed anchoring duties to all of the network's major programs, including the Today Show and Nightly News. And most recently, David served as the moderator of Meet the Press. Today, David will be sharing not only his take on politics and the media, but also his rather unlikely spiritual journey, which is the subject of his new book, How's Your Faith? So please join me in welcoming David Gregory to the Commonwealth Club.
Thank you.
I think David's book is one which reflects, I suspect, where many people are spiritually and psychologically in preparing for our conversation in the context of the killings around the world and what's going on. I read a brief description of the first Edinburgh Festival in 1947. In the wake of the Holocaust in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, there was Bach's B minor mass and Bruno Walter, who'd fled from Vienna, conducting the Vienna Philharmonic, the Verdi Requiem, and the festival was designed to be a celebration of the human spirit, but including the dark side of humanity. So I want to start with the big picture, mm-hmm. and ask you, you know, in about 3 minutes, as your kind of State of the Union address of where we are as a country and where what's going on in the world, particularly in the light of the book that you've written.
Well, I think in first of all, thank you all for coming, and it's really an honor to be back in San Francisco and to be here at the Commonwealth Club. I think we're at a really unsettled time politically in our country. There's lots of things that are working really well in America, lots of things that are working well in our economy, our innovation. Of course, we're in one of the engines of innovation in the world, being here in California. And yet we're at a really unsettled time because so many people around the country feel like our political system is rigged in a way only to benefit the powerful and the wealthy, and that there's so many people who are left out of that. And so there is this kind of anxiety and I think a real anger toward big institutions in our world, whether it's church, whether it's government, whether it's media, financial institutions. There is just this anxiety and this distrust. And this populism about, again, systems that are not looking out for average people. So I think that's fueling a lot of our politics right now, particularly on the Republican side, which we can get into in more detail, which is quite a story. So I think that anxiety is fueling a lot of what's happening in the country. I think we're in this kind of dynamic space in our information and in our culture where our culture's changing quickly. We have a media culture that's vastly more dynamic than it's ever been. And we're living in a time of great ferment around the world as there's human advancement, as there's more social cohesion, I think, around the world. But there is also, with that upheaval, a sense of people who feel left behind. And I think throughout a lot of the Muslim world, and certainly in the Middle East, we are in this age of throwing off dictatorship, throwing off all the trappings of colonial empire which created maps that are inauthentic. And it is a kind of coming home to roost after, you know, a century of imposition of a certain way of life. And in that void and in that ferment comes some of the darker forces in the world. Islamic fundamentalists, radical Islamists who believe literally in scripture and a return to what they see as a return to greatness of the 7th century and of the Ottoman period, which requires the imposition of Sharia law and brutality and a targeting of infidels or anyone who's not a true believer to set up something of a clash of civilizations, which is what I think these darker figures actually seek. So there's a lot that's happening in the world, but that occupying a lot of space because this threat of terrorism is mutating. We have moved from the era of the spectacular strike on America, which we saw in 9/11, Al-Qaeda and bin Laden believing that that was the way to really awaken the American, you know, tiger onto the world stage. And now we have a terrorist army and an ideology that believes not only in building what they're building in the power vacuums that exist, but also encouraging like-minded people to do what they can, where they can, to target the West. And those are terrible things. Those are very frightening things. And we're seeing, particularly in our response, the kind of fear that this instills in a democracy.
And if you add in the more domestic picture, where it seems to me that more and more people feel that the American dream is slipping away.
Right.
You've got a really toxic mixture of things there. So where, you know, where does religion fit into this? I mean, we could have a whole session on how religion ruins everything.
Right.
Or religion is somehow humanizing and helpful. So where what's happening to religion itself?
You know, I really want to assert an attempt at some humility here, not to overstate my ability to really wrestle with this, other than being a seeker and a student and on my own religious path to try to reckon with it, other than to say that I think you're right. There is so much about organized religion that so many feel is somehow at the root of this violence, and in many ways that is true. What we were talking about just a minute ago, what I fear is really at the root of some of this, is a sense of certainty.
Yeah, it's almost a cult of certainty.
A cult of certainty.
And it kills conversation because if I'm right and you're wrong,
right,
there's nothing to talk about.
I heard about a bumper sticker recently that I suspect we'd both put on our cars, which is, I don't know and you don't know either. but we live in an age where there are people who are willing to kill in the name of their certainty. I think that cover of the New York Daily News about gun control, saying God has not fixed this, and really taking on politicians who share their prayer thoughts and prayers with victims of gun violence, and that was a hollow act. I wrote on Facebook what I believe, which is I don't think we ought to mock prayer. I like to pray, not always very good at it, but I pray for guidance, and indeed I pray for God's presence and for healing, especially on the kinds of days that we've had recently. I'd rather have thoughts and prayers than not.
And there's a whole tradition of prayer as argument with God.
Sure.
Struggle with God.
Right.
There's a wonderful line in one of, someone will know, one of Samuel Beckett's plays where the hero comes forward, I think Clove comes forward and says, God, he doesn't exist, the bastard. Which is a kind of pious blasphemy in terms of struggling with meaning and purpose and at the same time kind of being terribly vulnerable as a human being. So I think prayer is much more rigorous and strange than people. It's not just, you know, asking for something.
And Abraham notably argued with God about of what was enveloping the world around him.
Yeah, yeah, sort of saying, well, how about if there's only
10 people
now, yeah, that kind of thing, yeah. You had a friend announce in the book, hey, I've come out as a seeker.
Right.
And that seems to describe you.
Yeah.
But how to put it, it took a kind of hand grenade thrown into your career to get you going. Or were you a seeker?
I was a seeker beforehand. Yeah, I mean, yeah. Losing my job at NBC brought me into a different realm of faith and belief, and being in a position for faith to teach me more, which I'll come back to. But I was at a place where I began to seek in a much more successful place. I was 45 now, so I must have been about 36. I was covering the White House, wonderful wife, Beth, and three wonderful children, very successful, and thinking, what else is there? Thinking, having been challenged by my wife to lead our family in faith, if we were to be a Jewish family, we're an interfaith family, she's a Protestant, thinking about how I wanted to lead our family. But then starting to really struggle, to feel a spiritual longing with the questions that we face. Who am I? How should I live? And what does it mean to be Jewish? What does it mean to be a person of faith? How do I find meaning and purpose in my life? These are questions that, while I can articulate them better now, were welling up inside of me. And in that way, I found the space and the room to say, yeah, hey, I'm a seeker, and to go down that path. And
which is really in contrast to your point about certainty.
It's not only, well, it's two things. It's in contrast to my point about certainty, because really I came from such a blank page. I mean, the title, How's Your Faith? A question the president asked me, President Bush, when he'd heard that I was studying with a Jewish educator, said, you know, was daunting because I was something of a blank page. I grew up in Los Angeles with a sense of cultural and ethnic identity as a Jew, growing up like a lot of non-Orthodox Jews do in America, with no real belief, with no real education about faith, about Judaism. And so it was something of a blank page that I had to both pursue a sense of identity, a sense of Jewish identity, but then to just go down the path of kind of opening my head and my heart to belief and to religious teaching. So I was actually kind of far away from certainty, because I was just so open to the experience.
Mm. So you that sort of radical openness. My struggle with the culture is that it seems to me that we're in a chronically fundamentalist culture, including the atheists. In that the atheist message is, if you're really honest, you've got to believe this stuff literally, and if you believe it literally, you're an idiot. So you're caught between, and I was thinking about this, there's that very well-known New Yorker cartoon of a big flashing sign on the side of the road, which says, "Welcome to Las Vegas, a faith-based community." And it struck me that, you know, it's very hard not to be faith-based, because you've got to have some assumptions. And Joseph Campbell put my dilemma in these terms. He says, half the people in the world think that the metaphors of their religious traditions are facts, and the other half contends that they are not facts at all. And as a result, we have people who consider themselves believers because they accept metaphors as facts, and we have others who classify themselves as atheists because they think religious metaphors are lies. And so this is why this kind of book and this kind of writing is important, because it cannot be put in, it's not a polemical book.
Right.
It's someone struggling honestly with the mystery of being here at all and being alive, the just sheer amazement at finding ourselves here.
Well, so, and I think there's something more powerful as opposed to certainty. I mean, we were talking before about our stories and the stories that we learn, our religious stories, our stories they're really about us. They were about these figures and who these figures were and what they did and whether it's truth or fiction. We don't really know. But we know that what our traditions teach us is about ourselves through these figures and through these stories. I believe they have contemporary resonance about how to live and about how to love and about how to treat each other. For me, faith is a personal path, and it is about a path of learning and discovery, and it's a path toward goodness that is a fraught path because you just fail all the way along. David Brooks, in his book, The Road to Character, writes, humility is awareness that you're always an underdog against your own weaknesses. Mm-hmm. To me, being more committed in my faith path is to come into contact more often with how often I fail at it, how many mistakes I make, and how flawed I am. Not that I've got it figured out or that I'm better than anybody, but the search for goodness piece is what I think our stories are about. That's what inspires me.
I mean, did you have, through the critical times you've been through, mm-hmm. I mean, did you have to learn self-forgiveness? Are you saying that as well?
I learned a lot of things. You know, when I lost my job, the first thing I thought was, you know what, I've got this. I have a sense of perspective. My friend Rachel Cowan, who's a wonderful rabbi in New York, she says, and we have a discussion in the book about asking yourself in a difficult situation, where is God in this? Mm. Where is God in this moment? And I asked that question of myself, and I found that I felt God was present. God was present in a sense of peace that I felt. God was there in the love that I felt from my wife and of the true friends that I had who came through that experience. So I thought I had perspective. I thought that I was living, you know, in this this moment when the day that everything unraveled and that NBC kind of forced the issue and leaked to the press that I was going to be out, even as we were negotiating the terms of that, we were driving up to get our kids from summer camp. Mm. And this is all breaking, and I don't have great cell reception, and it's all playing out on social media. And then I just kind of stopped, and I'm seeing my kids for the first time in several weeks, and I'm thinking, this is the juxtaposition of two things I really care about. My identity as a journalist, which I've been building up since I was 18, and I was at my highest point, and my identity as a father, which is so important to me. And now I have a real-time opportunity to do what I think God expects me to do, which is to try to be gracious in this moment. And I tweeted out my response to what was happening and tried to be thankful for the times that I had and the career that I had and to try to model something for my children. And that carried me, but what I didn't realize is how big of a blow losing my identity would be. Mm. And my faith did not always hold me. I struggled. I have struggled for a while. I made mistakes. I lost my way and felt adrift because this was a huge blow. But that's where faith always also teaches. In a lot of those fractures in the window was where a lot of the light came in for me and where true humility kind of emerged for me, a groundedness in faith to understand, well, things don't always work out as I'd planned. Mm-hmm. That when we talk about the 23rd Psalm, walking through the valley of death, it is not to stay in the valley of death, it is to walk through. Yeah. And that is that God has the power to renew my life if I'm seeking Him and I'm seeking to be the best person I can be. So in that way I felt, and what faith taught me through this period is to become more grounded in faith, to experience true humility, to realize how small I really am in the context of my life. Not something that I think is easily achieved in television news.
Well, you wrote something that has hit me a lot. It was, I was not going to be able to control the messaging. Hmm. And what happens, it's devastating when someone else grabs the narrative of your life.
Yeah.
And someone else is telling your story,
right?
And
for me, look, I mean, this was not. I mean, I wasn't fighting disease or poverty in America. I mean, I'm a journalist on television, and you know. But it was as if I'd done something wrong, as opposed to just I was doing my best, and we had some problems. And frankly, there was no reason, from a business point of view, that they should have made that choice. But they made the choice, and really. You know, I was the one who forced the issue. I mean, I was subject to a lot of leaks inside of NBC. Coming from NBC, they're being leaked and a lot of speculation about me. Right, and I didn't have control. And there's no question I felt stung by that. It's people, my dad used to always say, and my dad just died several weeks ago, so it's pretty raw. His lessons are pretty raw for me, but also so poignant. You know, he said, you know, you're going to have to develop a thick skin in your business. And I said, Right, I'll let you know when that happens. People say, oh, well, you must be used to all that scrutiny and all that criticism. Yeah. And I said, no. I said, my general view is that it hurts until it doesn't hurt anymore. Well, and that's kind of how you get through it.
You mentioned somewhere that you were laughed at and things like that.
Well, that was my son when I told the kids. Matt Lauer had called me and expressed his regret. And my son said, my oldest son said, why did Matt Lauer call you? And I said, well, son, because I'm not going to be doing Meet the Press anymore. And, so that's what's going to happen. And he was very thoughtful about the whole thing. He said, do we have to sell the house? And I said, no, honey, we don't have to do that. My daughter said, did you get fired? And I said, well, honey, I said, not exactly. I said, because I wasn't fired. I felt like I was fired and I felt I was going to be fired. But I did not get fired in that moment. I said, but they did want someone else to do the job. You must know that. And that's part of, you've seen the great part of my identity and my celebrity. There's another part too, including the fact that you need to face a lot of scrutiny and it's quite public. And my little boy, Jed, who's so sweet, he said, did they make fun of you, Daddy?
And I said,
yes, they did. Yes, they did. I said, but it's okay. I can handle it.
Well, you ask yourself, these deep questions, and you can feel both. What I was impressed with was you could feel a lot of the pain without any self-pity. I mean, I think that was your sense of pitch.
Well, thank you.
It was very, very touching, actually. And you asked yourself, who would you be if you lost it all?
Yeah.
And I think that's the other, questions, what happens when the story we've been telling ourselves about ourselves stops or becomes too painful?
I think they're related. I mean, my teacher, Erica Brown, was the one who asked me that question at a Starbucks early on in my tenure at Meet the Press. And she said she was not really someone who's plugged into the culture. She rarely watched me on television and was just not that, didn't follow it. So she was this kind of wonderful, Jedi master for me. And she asked me that question. And I said, I'm not sure how I'd answer that. And what I came to understand is what I explained just a moment ago, which is, again, that loss of identity was bigger, the pain was bigger, the shock was bigger than I thought it would be, than I gave it credit for. The journey that I have been on and that I am still on is what Richard Rohr writes about, the Franciscan priest, as he talks about Thomas Merton, the concept of the true self. The idea that when we come to understand who we are and whose we are, that we are living in relationship with God and not so much in contrast or in competition with each other, then we've really gotten to something. That's hard stuff for me to get to, but I appreciate it. And one thing I do know is that there is such a thing as the false self, which Rohr writes about, the person that we tell ourselves we are. And that's our ego telling us who we are. So at least if we're in a mode of striving to say, who I am is not what I do. Who I am is who I'm trying to become. And it is really much more a part of my humanity and my relationship with other people and my relationship with God. That's how I think I understand it. And I think that's a huge identity. And for me, really working on making that shift is still a work in progress.
So what about Beth, your Jedi Master?
Yeah, well, the Jedi Master is Erica.
Oh, Erica.
But okay. Beth is right. Beth is really Beth is an extraordinary woman. We met because she was prosecuting the Oklahoma City bombers. And she was actually responsible for arguing for the death penalty against Timothy McVeigh and made a very powerful argument, which the jury agreed with. So she's a formidable person. She was a captain in the Army. She was ROTC at Princeton, I was intrigued about you preaching at Princeton coming up this weekend. And she, the daughter of a nuclear submarine captain. So she's just incredibly smart. And she asked me a question that I sit with a lot, which is, I know what you are. I know you are culturally and ethnically Jewish, but what is it that you believe? She challenged me to lead our family in faith and spiritually. And she also challenged Judaism and what I believed and what the dogma was. And I think she has really pushed me to keep seeking, to keep reaching, to keep being better. But to also do what you talked about, which is to lead us and find a way for us as an interfaith couple that faces real challenges over the the fact that she feels a great sense of sacrifice in giving up sharing her religious traditions with our children. But can we find something that's universal, that's mutually reinforcing, and that emphasizes our humanity and our shared path? And I think we've done a lot along that path, and I think she's had a tremendous influence on me in that regard.
I mean, in terms of the family, would you say she has become Jewish?
No.
Or is she a Methodist, Jewish Methodist?
No, I think, I mean, in fact, I think one of the things that's hard, I think it's hard in Judaism in particular, is that it can be very exclusive. And part of the pain that we've gone through as a family is when my daughter, for instance, who's 10 now, but a few years ago, said, "But Mommy, you're not even Jewish." Or my son, who was just bar mitzvahed a few weeks ago, saying when Beth was helping with Hebrew, "Mom, you don't even understand this. You can't help me." It's very hard, I think, for the non-Jew to really be on that walk, because some of what we have been talking about our the stories that we share with one another and a kind of our common path can be overtaken by the tribalism and the ethnicity of Judaism. And I'm part of that as well. I mean, there's no question that I feel, you know, when my son was bar mitzvahed, I said to him, "Son, you are now going to be participating in a ceremony that boys your age have been participating in since the Middle Ages. As Rabbi Jonathan Sacks says, you are now part of the story. You are a letter in the scroll of this Torah we read. There is a connection to other Jews." All of that is powerful and wonderful, and also leaves others behind. Yeah. And I think my wife sometimes feels that.
Yeah. Though my experience of say, Passover, mm-hmm. and going, and I've been very blessed, is feeling I'm included.
Yes.
As well.
And I think Shabbat is like that. I mean, I think the Sabbath is like that too. But I write about that, and I think you're particularly right. And, you know, to me, as I read the Sermon on the Mount, I read from that during our Passover Seder because I felt that there's, you know, messages that are intuited to that as well.
I think a Jew did that.
I think, yes, he was, right. I knew it was good material.
I knew it was good material. There's a connection, there. By the same token, I'd want to confess, and this is a critique of American Christianity from Julian Barnes, the English novelist, who I mean, talking about prayer, he says that, what does he say? "I don't believe in God, but I miss him." this is his take on American Christianity. He says, "Old Europe took a more leisurely approach to the final arrival of the kingdom of heaven, a long moldering in the grave before resurrection and judgment, all in God's time. America and extreme Christianity likes to hurry things along. Why shouldn't product delivery follow promised order sooner rather than later? Hence, such fantasies as the rapture, in which the righteous, while going about their daily business, are instantly taken up into heaven, there to watch Jesus and the Antichrist duke it out down below on the battleground of planet Earth. The action man X-rated disaster movie version of the world's end." Mm-hmm. And that's something, you know, I have to live it. My peculiar thing as a priest is that I have a rabbi friend where we are theologically much more in tune with each other than I would be with, you know, my fellow Christians. Mm-hmm. So we're living in a, that's again back, this is a new genre of a book, I think, in mm-hmm. terms of trying to include more and more people in the conversation. But I want to have a go at you about your Judaism, because as you said, "To raise my kids Christian would have felt like a betrayal of my father's expectations and my ideas about myself being a cultural Jew." So then why did Beth agree to raise the children Jewish? And what does Jewish really mean for the kids?
Well, I think that's a question she asks herself a lot. And I think her answer is that at first she thought she was doing it because it would just be okay, it'd be good for the kids, that she wouldn't lose a sense of her own religious identity, and that it would just kind of create peace in the home and be okay. I think she was naive about that. I think I was selfish about it by not engaging a broader conversation because I didn't understand what it meant to sacrifice on the order that she was sacrificing. And she has come to regret the decision in part.
Oh.
Not wholly, but in part because she never fully realized how painful it would be to not share her traditions with our children. I've always been moved to tears by listening to my children recite the prayer over lighting the Shabbat candles. Yeah. And I asked a friend why that was, and she said, well, this isn't pride you're feeling. This is something deeper. It's a soulful connection. It's a soulful connection based on 4,000 years of history and tradition that you are now sharing with your children. It's a powerful feeling. I think my children understand their Judaism in terms of identity, in terms of it's who they are. I don't know that they would put it this way, but that they are part of a bigger story. And I think they understand it of being in relationship with God, being in some kind of partnership with God, to be kind, to learn how to treat other people well, to seek goodness. Those are the tenets of religious identity I want them to have, and I would like them to understand it and to be rooted in Jewish identity and Jewish theology as a kind of starting point for them, mm-hmm. where they can do what I hope to be doing, which is also honoring other religious traditions, namely that of their mother.
There's a, I don't know whether you've heard of a, I don't know whether he's still alive, a wonderful English rabbi called Lionel Blue.
I've heard of him.
Broadcasting, and he, a reformed rabbi after the war, was in charge of legal things, and he got tired of the legalism and founded a synagogue called the Synagogue of the Unqualified. And his basic line is, if you feel unqualified, you know you're in the right place. It was just an amazing, inclusive thing. It sounds a very, I'm not being facetious, but do you have a Christmas tree?
Yes.
So you do have a Christmas
tree. And I grew up with that.
Okay.
And see,
a menorah and a Christmas tree.
Yeah. I mean, okay. You know, Hanukkah is not as religiously significant as other Jewish holidays. I love Christmas, and I not only love it in a secular way, I love it in the religious way. I mean, I always try to be very explicit with the kids about what is the meaning of Christmas, and I've always been drawn to it and feel a great sense of joy around it.
Yeah. I mean, you mentioned Rabbi Mordecai Kaplan, who was excommunicated in 1945 by the Union of Orthodox Rabbis. And Kaplan did the first bat mitzvah, you said, for his daughter Judith. And his insistence that you can do Judaism without God.
Right.
With G-D rather than God. So you didn't start from scratch.
Mm-hmm.
No one does. A secular Jewish father, where you changed the name to Gregory from Ginsburg.
Mm-hmm.
And that's an American story in itself, actually.
Because he wanted to be an actor, and I guess it's you know, not so easy for Jews to make it in show business.
So,
oh, wait.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Now in the early 50s.
You were born in Los Angeles, right?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. I've got to think about that one.
Yeah, I mean, exactly.
Yeah. It's... And I don't mean this facetiously. A secular Jewish father and an alcoholic Catholic mother who was very, you know, not lapsed only, but collapsed.
Yes.
And can you say something about your mom?
Yeah, I mean, well, you know, her alcoholism was certainly a troubling backdrop to our childhood. And she was arrested for drunk driving when I was in the car when I was 15. Which was very painful for her, for me. And she got sober the next day and has been for nearly 30 years. I mean, hers is a remarkable story of kind of collapsing, her faith collapsing, I think is a nice way of putting it, a true way of putting it. And yet in recovery, she's pursued a spiritual identity that's quite robust and meaningful to her. And I think, and propels her and gives her a certain life spirit that is not so easy to achieve. But I think, you know, just to tie a couple of things you said together, you know, the nature of belief is something that I've thought a lot about, coming from that, you know, the background that I come from. The idea of belief and seeking relationship with God is something that is important to me. And I believe it's important to every Jew, whether a Jew recognizes it or acknowledges it or not. Oftentimes I speak about the search for God and the spiritual touch and feeling grace, and they think, oh, well, that's Christianity talking. I say, well, I don't know, but all I know is that if you read the Psalms, Jews are constantly seeking God's face, to live in communion with God, and to have an intimate relationship with God. And Psalm 37, which we read during the High Holidays, we talk of, even if our mother and father shall abandon us, God will take us in. That's pretty intimate.
Yeah. I'm going to remind the radio audience that this is the Commonwealth Club of California program, and we're talking to veteran television journalist David Gregory about politics, the media, and the spiritual journey outlined in a new book, How's Your Faith? An Unlikely Spiritual Journey. I'm Alan Jones, your moderator. And you can hear Commonwealth Club programs on the radio, catch up with us on Facebook and Twitter, and see program videos on your YouTube channel. We've had some great questions here, and I want to sort of share a couple of them. One is, disregarding what people have told you in church and otherwise, what have you personally perceived in your life that has convinced you that there is a God?
I guess I experience God in, you know, the love that surrounds me in my life, the love of my children, the love of my wife. I think a certain peace that I have come to know at important times in my life. And, you know, the voices in my head, which could be interpreted different ways. But it is that, you know, if the idea is that we experience God in the whispers, in the still small voice, I think we all have that voice inside of us. And however we come to understand that voice, it is a voice of conscience. It's a voice of that part of our nature that wants us to be better, that wants us to grow, that is the basis of our humanity. It's our soul and our kind of spiritual longing. I think the longing is in fact the communication from God. And one more tangible aspect of it is the experience that I've just had, if I might share this, in the past few weeks. When my father died, my father, not a religious man, and as he got closer to death, he was enthralled by my book. He was at first quite uncomfortable with the details that I share about my childhood. But then he kind of got past that and was just fascinated because he didn't understand where this interest and this commitment was coming from in me. But he more than respected it. He was enthralled by it. And his body was ravaged. His mind was quite sharp, but he was declining and declining quickly. And he got scared and he felt vulnerable. And I spoke to him about prayer. I spoke to him about God's presence, about the Psalms, when even if I should travel to the westernmost shore, even there you'll be with your hand upon my shoulder. And to take comfort in God's presence. And he died on a Thursday, and on the Wednesday I was leaving him, and I said, Dad, I hope to see you again, but if I don't, if you die before I return, I want you to know that that's okay, that my heart is full, that I'm so lucky that you're my father, and that there's nothing between us that has been left unsaid. Mm. And I took his hand, and I prayed that wonderful poem in our tradition, Adon Olam, into your hands, my soul, I place when I awake and when I sleep. God is with me, I shall not fear. Body and soul from harm will he keep. And my dad just smiled and said, that's beautiful. And I held his hand. And, you know, to me, that was a moment where prayer was all I had. It was bigger than the words that we could say to each other. It was including God in that moment. And he died the next day. And I feel such beauty in that moment and such beauty in his passing. I couldn't have asked for a better parting. Mm. And to me, as best as I can understand it, is God's grace.
Mm. My mind is whirling about the word God, and the we were taught in seminary that there is, don't believe in a God, believe in God, but not a God, as if the God is an item or an object in a whole list of objects. And so there's a whole sort of theological, messy conversation that needs to be had when we talk about God. It's like Woody Allen, you know, God is an underachiever, is his line about about not being there. On the other hand, being caught up in that total amazement and mystery of being here right. at all, and having that tenderness with your father was right. just beautiful. And so on. Tell us a bit about your mother.
Well, you know, I shared her alcoholic story, and I, you know, one of the things that I write about is also kind of coming to grips with that, and you know, how her, you know, the question of forgiveness. You know, part of this walk for me is to feel truly humbled, truly humbled. I write a chapter in which I say, "Who are we to judge our parents?" True humility is becoming a parent yourself and finding that you're making the same mistakes that you vowed not to make. I had hoped to make mistakes in a brand new category of parenting. And yet, whether it's controlling my anger, which I was afraid of my father because of his temper, to repeat those kinds of mistakes is deeply humbling. And I've struggled with that with my mother as well. And the idea of turning my back on my mother and realizing that, God forbid, I should make a mistake like my mother made. I would never want my children to turn their backs on me. And so I think she represents something really important, which is, you know, the gift of redemption in our lives, and also the struggle of forgiving a parent and making peace with a parent's full humanity and the fact that you know, we all are flawed and we're all doing the best we can. And from the child to the parent, kind of making peace with that is a transition that I feel like I've been able to make. The relationship's not always perfect, but I feel that's what I'm after.
Just aside here, there's a couple of very amusing things I like a lot here. Thank you. Says, to heck with religion, how about a book on NBC?
Right.
Thank you for that.
Yeah, I know. Well, and it's, you know, it's interesting. You know, look, NBC is, you know, I've made a conscious decision that I don't want to delve publicly mm-hmm. into, you know, what I know and what I experienced. And that's for a couple of reasons. One, I don't think it's becoming. Two, it would fight against something I really believe, which is I had a wonderful career at 20 years at NBC. I learned a lot. I thrived. I was stimulated. I had the experiences journalistically of a lifetime, and also had some really wonderful relationships that I still have, many that I don't. But I do have a number of great relationships.
You mentioned
a lot
Chris
of friends
Matthews.
There. Yeah, and Chris is not somebody that I'd ever really been close with, but we had an encounter. You know, one of the things that my teacher would teach me is, you know, you have to try to bring some of these, this path for goodness into your work life and work it there. And I remember I was mentioned in a piece in a negative light that was a piece about him that was kind of unflattering and to him. And it was just talking about how ambitious I was. Then there was an anecdote about him and Russert and Andrea Mitchell getting on a flight and Matthew saying, oh, well, Gregory's hoping that we all go down, you know, so he can take, he thought, his job or Tim's job or whatever. And I was asked for a comment about that, and I didn't give a comment about it. And I decided to write him a note, frankly, at the urging of my teacher to say, please don't lose any, you know, sleep over that. I'm sure it was said in a different context, and I'm not troubled by it at all. I'm sorry that was an unfortunate piece, and we're just fine. And she said that because she said, you should do some. I said, but why would I do that? I'm annoyed by that. I mean, my heart wouldn't be in it. And she said, and there's a wonderful Jewish teaching, which is, if you do something for the wrong, if you do the right thing for the wrong reason, maybe you'll come to do it for the right reason. And be big, be transcendent. And it was a moment that brought he and I closer together, and he was quite gracious when I left. The other reason I don't want to, you know, dwell on the NBC stuff is that it really does, I mean, I am trying to I am trying to forgive what I thought was done to me and some bad things that were done to me, and I wouldn't be worth or worthy of this path I'm trying to be on, even in all of my failure in it, if I went down that road. Okay.
It's like drinking from a poison water hole all the time.
The other one,
I wouldn't have dared ask. Thank you again. Is one. One quick political question. Will Trump still be leading after Super Tuesday in March?
So I think the Trump phenomenon, again, the Trump phenomenon is about an anger and a populism and a kind of deep-seated anxiety about the future of the country and the nature of our politics. It is also rooted in a kind of an effort to delegitimize our leadership. And this is not just something that's happened to Obama, it happened to Bush, it happened to Clinton. So it's part of the political culture. It's also a quest for authenticity that people desperately seek in our culture and in our politics and in our public life generally. We reward authenticity, and we seek it like never before. And there, for those people who are, frankly, not very educated, might be left out of the economy, might be kind of, disaffected by how quickly the culture is moving. If you really think the country's going to hell, there's nothing like a guy who stands up and says, the country's going to hell and I'll fix it. And it'll be fabulous again because I'm brilliant and I can do it. And there's nothing like a guy who says to people who are afraid, let's keep all the Muslims out because we don't know if they're here to bomb us or do something else. Let's just keep them all out. And there's people who say, hell yeah. So there's a precedent for this, right? I mean, we've seen demagogues in politics, whether it was George Wallace in 68, Goldwater in 64, whose slogan was, in your heart, he's right. And I think there's a lot of Trump in that today. I was just asked this question last night, and I dismissed the idea that he'd run as a third party. Mm-hmm. We're seeing, I guess he's not dismissing it now, and there's polling indicating a lot of his supporters would support him. It doesn't surprise me. George Wallace was polling at 20% in 1968 until he chose general or someone from the Air Force, right? And then he kind of tanked, and then they ended up at 13.5%, which is still pretty significant. So I could see him running as a third party. He can self-fund. He's not beholden to anybody. And he's in many ways fortified by angst within the Republican establishment and in the kind of political class and in the media class.
And that's sort of what hits me in the religious circus of America.
Yeah.
That whole issue of religious identity is sort of meaningless. He says... He claims to be a Presbyterian.
Right.
What on earth does that mean?
Yeah, right. And wherever you come from religiously, I mean, to be so void, to have such a void in a sense of compassion and a sense of empathy and humility and rationality, which can be part of all of this too. And to hearken back, by the way, to hearken back to what I think we all in our modern society regard as a pretty dark period of our history, the internment of the Japanese. To invoke that as justification is to appeal to our most base fears and our irrationality. He's a pretty dark figure who I think, I think the media ought to be involved in just kind of reporting this stuff out and people make their judgment. I'd be hard-pressed to believe that he's there in the end, but I don't know what derails him completely, because most of what he's done by normal political calculus is completely disqualifying, completely. Mm. And he hadn't been disqualified yet. But I hasten to add, nobody's actually cast a vote yet. So
he's sort of touched a nerve, in the culture. But there isn't what I find hard going is the absence of good public conversation about important things.
Right.
Just miss that terribly. There's a question also here that I think is pointing to something that's on people's minds, and that issue of fundamentalism. How would you confront evil Muslim fundamentalism with Christian, Jewish, and Hindu fundamentalism?
Well, I think the way to confront it is to do battle with any certainty. I mean, I think we have to reject the imposition of religious certainty on anyone in public life, by government. Religious certainty and religious fundamentalism, I think, is dangerous, because anyone who claims to have a monopoly on the truth is someone who scares me, because I just don't know how you arrive at that and then start taking action as a result of it. I think it gets you to a dangerous place that gives rise to a lot more hate than love, and so that's not what
I believe.
There's
a sort of argument that it's to do with the evolution of religious consciousness, that there is a very famous description in the late 12th century of the Crusaders marching into Jerusalem, and the reports coming in of slaughtering all the Jews, all the Muslims, old people, children, mm-hmm. and Christianity having to break away from a Constantinian triumphalist vision, to see the contradiction in doing all that in honor of the Prince of Peace, and that you've got now a kind of critique of that, and mm-hmm. some people have argued that Islam too has got to go through a kind of reformation.
Right.
I don't know enough about Hindu fundamentalism, but you know how that has affected people in India is very, very strong and powerful too. So I think you're right that it's the cult of certainty,
right,
which again undermines any kind of learning or conversation, because if I'm right and you're wrong, there's nothing to talk about.
And I do think that I believe in that kind of reformation, and I think there's a lot of work to be done within the Muslim world to take a leadership role in seeking something of a moderate path and finding space for Muslim belief without a degeneration into, you know, the kind of scriptural literalism that has led to so much violence.
Well, one thing for me about the scriptures, particularly the Hebrew scriptures and the New Testament and so on, strangely, is their contradictory nature. Mm-hmm. That they're texts arguing with themselves. And that makes me think, well, maybe they are the Word of God after all. in that there's that the why I love your tradition, the Jewish tradition, the rabbinical method of interpreting Scripture is endless argument. No one gets the last word. Three Jews, four opinions. And I think that is a very, very powerful witness of Judaism at its best. Mm. Is and I mentioned that Orthodox rabbi that I knew in New York City when talking about orthodoxy, and he said that the first test of anyone's orthodoxy is this question: if you were in charge, would I be safe? Mm. And if the answer is yes, we can fight and argue about anything. The issue is not so much of belief, mm-hmm. but of trust.
Right.
And how do we develop a sufficient trust so that we could have a good row, a good argument about
right.
things without feeling that if you were in charge, I'd be done in by that? There's a question that you might want to avoid because it's asking for judgment, but I think it's a very good question. One of the things that I've loved about you as a journalist was your intelligence and persistence during your interviews. Can you critically evaluate the quality of television news and how it has changed over the past few years?
Well, I think one of the things that I'm troubled by in the cable culture is this kind of reductionism of news in this constant, you know, in the 24/7 cable and internet news cycle. I mean, I think that we get less quality information in a lot of cases. And I don't think there's as much kind of thoughtful preparation, and I don't think there's as much experience. I think because of the economic changes in the news, you don't have the kind of breadth of experience for somebody who's coming up, you know, in network news in particular. You know, you're not coming up through working in local news the way that I did, and then covering different parts of the country and working with good producers and just getting some real experience. And then perhaps, you know, covering, you know, stories overseas, and then having an opportunity to cover politics for a long period of time. So I think there's just this kind of experience deficit. And I think that there's too much of a hollowing out of these networks of real judgment and real experience. And I think all of that has a place in, you know, a lot of this news getting less serious. And there's so much competition that we're spending less time on helping people understand the issues of our day. We maybe have moved beyond just pure informing, because there's so many ways to get information. But our job ought to be to help you understand better. And I don't think that we're living up to that. I think too often we're failing at that.
And information isn't enough.
It's not enough, particularly with how fractured the news media is. There's so much more responsibility on the part of all of us to evaluate and assess the credibility of the information we get, and to resist the temptation in ourselves to seek information that validates our own view of the world. If we stop challenging ourselves to argue with ourselves and to challenge our own beliefs, I don't think we learn and I don't think we grow. There's a lot of good commentary. There's lots of good and different points of view. But part of what troubles me about what's happening in our country and even in our college campuses is this roiling debate and sense that we shouldn't have to be subject to other points of view.
Yeah.
And I just don't think that's how you grow.
I was wondering, too, if I had a criticism of the book, is that you were very self-critical. But I wondered where you felt you were a bit uncritical when you, I'm having to be careful here, when you were interviewing Cardinal Dolan in New York or Joel Osteen in Houston, because you turned to people of strong belief, but as we've discussed this issue about certainty, isn't some strong belief simply toxic? And so, I mean, I'm not asking you to criticize those two.
No, but I understand what you're saying. I mean, I think, you know, I reached out to certain figures that I knew, or I knew who had big followings that I thought the audience would know and the readers would know. But I didn't put a test on them, and I didn't want to, again, I this was not a work of scholarship by my, you know, by me. To distinguish between those who you ought to listen to and maybe pay less attention to. It was just kind of a path of learning for me. So I think it's a fair criticism to say, in a way, the tension I have with myself, which is if I'm someone who's trying to be, you know, so open and non-judgmental, then why am I seeking the views of those who are more doctrinaire? That's a fair criticism.
Because I think I want you to write another book.
Yeah.
And I want you to go and interview atheists.
Yeah.
Because you will get a similar broad spectrum of amazing, generous-spirited atheists that I know, and others who are just as crazy and fundamentalist as others, depending on who you talk with.
Right.
And I think that will get us off that treadmill of belief. I find I get less and less interested in people's beliefs, and I want to really know if I can trust them. And that becomes a kind of much more of an issue, because you can go, for example, in my tradition, you can go to hear a sermon and all the words are right, and you smell a rat, because there's something not authentic or loving.
You know, when I interviewed Russell Moore of the Southern Baptist Convention, he was really the only one, and he did it in a very respectful way, and he's been very supportive. And he basically said to me, and not these words, but he said, you know, look, this journey you're on is charming, but ultimately you have to decide who God is. And if you have not decided who God is, then you are not complete. And he said in an interview about the book, he said, what I told David is belief is not enough. It is belief in what that matters. And to a conservative Christian, it is to accept Christ as your Lord and Savior, and to have, as C.S. Lewis wrote, that Christ life inside of you, and to kind of, that is your path to eternal salvation.
But I believe that. I'm a Christian, right. I believe that. But I think what I have to face is that among atheists and non-Christians, they are more Christ-like than many Christians. Mm.
Well, but I think you believe something else just based on our conversation, which is the trust factor, which I really like, which is do we necessarily share belief, but can we trust each other? And is that trust built on the idea that we're both in it together? Yeah. And the in it is that we're trying to live as best we can, yeah. And we're trying to seek, you know, goodness in the world.
I think the revolutionary thing is, and I find it again with an atheist friend, is two doctrines. Mm-hmm. One is everybody matters, and the other is we're in this together. Mm-hmm. And everything else is a footnote to those two things, mm-hmm. and how we work it out. And I find your book both wise and healing in that sense. It's inviting a wider conversation with a wider audience. I wanted to mention
that.
Your mentor and friend, Erica.
Yes.
You asked her if her own deep faith had given her a sense of certitude. Mm. Remember back to certitude and truth. And she said, no, not at all. I actually feel that religion has made my life more nuanced and confusing. I live with the ambivalence continuously. And I think that is trying to get that across. It's rather like having a passion for moderation. You know, it is to be passionate about that kind of approach to mystery, which would drive people who have a longing or lust for certainty crazy. And how do we kind of open that up and tolerate that? What education is about, right. To be able to have, you talked about our institutions. We could have another hour or so on the academy, on the mm-hmm. universities, mm-hmm. Where we're all struggling now about who's in and who's out and what kind of curriculum should be taught.
And I think, again, something we were talking about earlier, there is, we talk about the difference between religion and spirituality, which, and you don't like that, you know, that distinction, and I agree
well,
with you.
It's not that I'm much more gentle about
yeah,
it.
Yeah, right.
I used to call people who said I'm spiritual but not religious, I used to call them parasites, but I don't do that. I'm much more gentle about
but that. But my point in bringing that up is that the idea, I guess the caricature of somebody on the spiritual journey is that you're kind of always journeying and never arriving.
Right.
And that there's never a sense of a moral horizon. And that's not where I am.
No, I agree.
I think that I'm constantly journeying. But I do believe and try to live by certain precepts, even if I fail at them. Whether they're right or, I don't always know, but they seem like it's just about trying to live as best you can. So in that way, the fact that we're always in motion and as long as we remain unsatisfied with the notion that, with the idea that we don't really arrive, we're just in motion. Erica said to me, she said, you know, this idea that you're going to get your hands around this tradition and that you're going to study all the books and you're going to get to everything, you know, once you let go of that, then you'll really be on this.
Yes. No, she's absolutely right.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
I resonate that. A retired priest, a friend of mine in his 80s, he said, I'm not sure I believe this stuff anymore. Hmm. But it's still the best way to live. Hmm. In other words, that get caught up into the belief structures when it's a response to stories, you know. It's when people say to me, I can't believe in the virgin birth. I say, forget
right.
about that.
Right.
Look at a woman with a baby. Any woman, any baby, and ask yourself, how should I treat people? Start there. Start with the imagination rather than somehow a kind of intellectual grasp of something.
Right. And for me, you know, Cardinal Dolan said something to me that resonated, and it was like what Joel Osteen said. But Dolan said to me, he said, the problem with a project like this can be if you treat it as something of a project. He said, ultimately, faith is an act of love. It's a dare. It's the story of Jesus and his disciples, and he says that they should cast deep back in the Sea of Galilee when they had an unproductive day, and they decided, okay, we'll give it a go, and then their baskets were full of fish. It was a dare. And in that way, this is something that has moved from my head into my heart, a belief structure because I do believe it is a way for me to live. It's aspirational. And Joel Osteen talked about having a heart for God, you know, an openness for experience. And I haven't got it figured out, and yet I it makes sense to me to try to become better through this path.
Well, I'm looking forward to your next book where you have a go at Bill Maher. And we have to come to a conclusion, but as the preacher tonight, you're the preacher, what's your word to the people gathered here and listening in? What would be your word to people today?
Let me say at the outset how incredibly thankful I am to you, and what a joy this has been to be in conversation with you and to get to know you. This was really meaningful. I think about the prophet Micah, and that we should walk humbly before our God. I think we live at a time of certainty and upheaval, and humility is probably something to hold close during these times as we seek peace and reconciliation.
That's lovely. So, thanks to veteran television journalist. Do you mind being called veteran?
As long as I still feel youthful, I don't
know. Okay, youthful veteran television journalist David Gregory, author of How's Your Faith? An Unlikely Spiritual Journey. I want to thank you, the audience here, for tremendous questions. And on the radio and television and on the internet, I'm Alan Jones, Dean Emeritus of Grace Cathedral. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.